Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Sustainable City Design Specialist Dr. Mark Roseland from Simon Fraser University in Canada. You know, another thing that comes to mind as we talk about this, there is a strange resistance to becoming more sustainable developing in the United States. Unbelievably, a few people in the Occupy movement in the U.S. are afraid any move towards sustainability is part of a United Nations plot to take over the world. They think everything's part of Agenda 21, which came out of the first Rio conference. So I have to ask you straight out, are you part of a plot to take over the world?
Oh, absolutely. And I'm holding my breath because I'm going to do it so soon. No, it's actually funny that you should mention this because it's something I've been watching with great interest, not from the Occupy group. I don't know where they're getting I do know where they're getting it from. The pushback to sustainability is not coming from Occupy. It is coming from the Tea Party in the United States. And the Republican National Committee in January of 2012 targeted Agenda 21 specifically, you know, in, as they usually do, as a United Nations plot to have international agreements be more important than national sovereignty. And so, you know, this is nothing new from the right wing in the United States when they're talking about the United Nations. That's nothing new. But what is new is that they specifically targeted ICLEI and local Agenda 21. And ICLEI is an acronym that stands for the International Council for Local Environmental Initiatives, an organization that is of, by, and for local governments, and has changed its name in recent years to ICLEI Local Governments for Sustainability. Now, I do a lot of work in cooperation and partnership with ICLEI. The foreword to my new book is written by the Secretary General of ICLEI. So I take this attack on ICLEI to somewhat personally as, at least indirectly, an attack on exactly the work that I do. And it would be laughable were it not for the fact that the facts that they come up with are not facts at all. I'm just amazed at the stuff that came out of the Republican National Committee that has been parroted by local Republican National Committees around the U.S. And there's no evidence for any of it. It's just made up. But what is happening is that local governments are basically being discouraged from joining ICLEI, from paying their dues, and from efforts to combat sprawl and to fight climate change. They're being told that this is some kind of, you know, international conspiracy, and it's just nuttiness. It's absolutely insane. The work that local governments are doing is clearly what's leading any progress that we're having. If we look over the last 20 years from Rio 92 to Rio 2012, with very few exceptions, we have seen very little in the sense of international agreements or national governments taking a lead on this stuff. The action and the traction has been at the local level, to some extent from the civil society and a few sectors of socially responsible businesses, but it's largely been from local communities leading the way. And I think Rio plus 20 just confirmed that, you know, if we're putting all our hopes on the United Nations to solve the planet's global problems, we're pretty hooped. So it is definitely going to be leadership from the local level yet again.
Right. We've been talking about ICLEI, and listeners, you can Google that and find out more about it. And Mark Roseland, I think some paranoid Americans are missing a chance at their best allies. I've even seen attacks on transition towns as a communist plot. But these same people are calling for three things. They want local action, they want participation in local governments, and they want to prepare for disasters, or calling it prepping. So isn't that exactly the sorts of things that you're helping local governments to do?
It is and it isn't. So, I mean, a lot of this stuff is very similar to the survivalist movement, which seems to have reared its head again of the late 70s and early 80s. And the modern version of that in some ways is in transition towns, which comes out of the notion of resilience, and it's a nice idea. It comes out of the natural sciences, and it says that we need to be resilient, to be able to withstand shocks, and those can be economic shocks, ecological shocks, social shocks, and that's good, and that's important. But withstanding shocks is, I think, is a notion, and resilience is a notion that works better when you're looking at ecological systems and ecological communities than it does when you're looking at human communities, because there's nothing about transformation necessarily in the notion of resilience. Now, transition towns, I think, is one of the better versions of that. But what's important about sustainability is that the argument that sustainability is not that we need to simply maintain what we have in order to keep it from being injured or devastated by natural or other disasters, but that we need to become a better society, that we can't just freeze ourselves where we're at, that to become an ecological society or sustainable society, we, again, like the community capital framework, we have to improve our scores on all of these counts, all aspects of community capital, or all pillars of ecological, social, and economic sustainability. If we do only one at the expense of the others, it'll come back to bite us.
Well, I guess some of our listeners are going to disagree with you, because I know we have people who think that cities are not sustainable just in their nature, that they must always be gathering more and more from a hinterland or from a global hinterland that won't be able to supply the billions of people who live in them. What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, indeed. Most cities are not sustainable, and you can't really look at a city on its own, because cities do have what my colleague Bill Reese has termed an ecological footprint, and that footprint tends to be larger than the cities themselves. So you have to look at cities as certainly urban regions, and in a global economy, in a global society, they are international centers as well. But the point is that cities are where most people live. They are the source of many of our most serious ecological problems, and they're also where the potential for ecological solutions lie.
But I want to get a little bit more detailed. You were at the Rio Plus 20 conference in Brazil last June, and most pundits called it a total failure. Governments wrote another useless document, they said. But I know the gathering was a hotbed of networking for activists like yourself. For example, you launched something called Community Capital. Now, what is that?
So let me just say about the Rio event. The media attention was on the 175 or 200 heads of state from around the world, and I would agree that what they actually signed was an extremely weak document. But what was interesting about Rio was not those 200 people, but the 50,000 others who were there, and that was an amazing group of people who came from all around the world to share ideas, share successes, talk about strategies, and essentially do whatever we could to move the agenda forward, because if it's not going to be moved forward by the United Nations, then it's got to be moved forward by somebody, and that's why we were there. So in terms of community capital, my book, Towards Sustainable Communities, uses a community capital framework, and those who are familiar with the sustainable development literature will know that most of the discussion in North America and around much of the world is, and since Rio in 92 and the Brundtland Commission report, Our Common Future, in 1987, has talked about sustainable development as an integration of three aspects or pillars, some would call it, and it's the ecological, the economic, and the social. And while people give a lot of lip service to the integration of those three, in practice, it's very hard to do, and people don't really know what to do with them. We know about the ecological. We know a lot about ecological integrity. We don't know quite so much about how to do economic development that's not at the expense of the environment. And then the social dimension of sustainability, there's a lot of confusion about what that means. What is social sustainability? So what I've done with the community capital framework is make something that's a little more nuanced than the sort of three legs of sustainability, but a lot easier to deal with than a human brain, than 200 indicators. Firstly, I've taken the concept of sustainable development, sustainability, and I do think talking about it in terms of assets rather than deficiencies is really important. Many communities are looked at by others in terms of their deficiencies, and it doesn't really take advantage of what they do have. So when I use capitals, that's really my way of talking about assets. But the other reason I use the term capital, quite frankly, is that in our society, even though you know, people don't necessarily have money. They understand the notion of capital really well, whereas they don't understand natural systems nearly as well. So I've broken down sustainability into six capitals: natural capital, physical capital, economic capital, human capital, social capital, and cultural capital. And in the book, they appear as a hexagon. And in the center, they are held together and catalyzed and coordinated by what I call community mobilization. So one of the things that's exciting about the new book is that I've been playing with this framework for a while, but we've turned this into a community capital tool. So I've taken this basic hexagon and worked with colleagues at Tilburg University in the Netherlands. And we now have this wonderful free online tool that's in English and Portuguese and Spanish, and we'll hopefully be in other languages in months and years to come. And it allows people to get a good visualization of sustainability. So when a community is trying to make a decision about what to do, or a choice between two proposals, or whether to do a certain project or not, this tool provides a really good and quick and easy way for people to see what the effect of a decision would be on each of these six forms of capital.
But there is the question of money. And as you know, all around America and Europe, cities are just loaded up with debt. And there isn't that much money for greening in the developing world either. Some of them are struggling. So how can cities get anything progressive done while they may be laying off police or cutting social services? What do you see happening in this framework?
Well, you know, that's the interesting thing, that at Rio plus 20, so 20 years after the original Rio conference in 1992, we're really still talking about what sustainability means. Because if you interpret sustainable development as really just environmental protection, which is what most people are still doing, then it's an added cost to be traded against, and you're going to trade it off when times are tight against other really important things, like social services and affordable housing and so on. But if you see sustainability and sustainable development as an integration of environment, economy, and social inclusion, then it's not so much a trade-off. It's about doing development differently. So in my view, when we build affordable housing, but it's not green, it's not energy efficient, it's simply not good enough. Or likewise, when we build green buildings that aren't affordable, that's not good enough. To be sustainable, we have to win on all of these scores.
Well, let's look at another thing that you launched at Rio Plus 20 last June, and that was Pando. Why the name, and what does Pando do?
Pando, let me tell you what it is first and then the name. Pando is a network that links sustainable communities researchers like myself with sustainable communities practitioners, like local government and corporate sustainability officers. The reason for doing Pando is that the book is in its fourth edition. As you said, the first editions were subtitled Resources for Citizens and Their Governments. In 2012, I struggled as I was putting together this fourth edition. What is a resource book in 2012 and beyond? Will anybody even read books anymore in 2015? I don't know. But certainly I felt that a resource book would be obsolete before it was even made it to the printer. So I changed the subtitle from Resources to Solutions. So the new book is called Toward Sustainable Communities, Solutions for Citizens and Their Governments. And the way I dealt with the resource issue was that I had been working with ICLEI and with researchers in British Columbia and around the world for some time, and we have not been as well organized as we, I think, need to be. So the idea with Pando was to create a network where we could find each other more easily, where researchers could find each other, where researchers and practitioners could work across their kind of cultural gap between those of us in the academic world and the research world and those in the municipal and government and business world. Pando refers to the grove of aspen trees in the in Utah's Colorado Plateau. There are some 87,000 individual trees, but they're actually all connected at the roots. It's actually a single living organism, and it's one of the largest and oldest and most resilient organisms on the planet. And to us. That was a really nice symbolic representation of many separate people working together. And so that's why we called it Pando. And listeners can go to pando.sc and check it out themselves.
Well, maybe that's a really good sign that there are just so many ideas coming from so many points around the world about what we can do, that we need a centralized register to find out what it all is going on.
Well, I think that's part of it. Again, we're not trying with Pando to be a website, although it has that quality as well. I mean, there's lots of websites. Anybody can go to a website, but this has more of the, there's a public side of Pando, which anybody can go to and see information. So as I said, you know, how does a resource book stay current? Well, it's not. So the resources are constantly being updated by, not only by me, but all the other people who are on Pando are uploading their own resources. And so that's how I dealt with the question of a resource book. But the more important thing is that on Pando, you can find other people who are interested in this kind of work. And we have been, I mean, when I started doing this work 20, 25 years ago, I mean, you know, I could count on one hand the number of other researchers who were, you know, working actively with communities and with cities in this area. Now there are several hundred of us, and you know, there are people working in local governments who are the sustainability officers, people in corporations who are VP sustainabilities. There are academics who have chairs in sustainability. There are people getting degrees in sustainability. None of this stuff was happening 20 years ago. So it's the sustainability world has really blossomed in a wonderful way. It's clearly more than any one person can keep a handle on. And that's a great thing. But what we're trying to do is actually, as I said, mobilize collaboration. So on Pando, if you sign up, which is free to become a member of Pando, then you can contact other members directly. You can post announcements. You can say, I'm looking for a collaborator for an international grant proposal or whatever it is that you're looking to do. And you can also do things like say, I am going to this conference. Is anybody else on Pando going to be there? And if so, let's meet for coffee. So it has some of that Facebook type of quality of really trying to see networking, not only in the digital modern sense, but in the pre-digital sense that some of us older folks appreciate, where networking is a verb. It's something that we do with other people, not only something that happens on a computer.
Well, Mark, as we wrap up, maybe we need a couple of success stories. Could you just tell us about one or maybe two projects in some part of the world where cities have really improved their sustainability?
There are really lots of these. One of the things I did in the new edition of the book that I hadn't done before was a chapter on communities integrating sustainability. Because in the early editions, we just really couldn't say that we had that. We had cities that had done fantastic things on transportation infrastructure or on waste and recycling or on, you know, one particular aspect of sustainability, but not sort of pulling it all together. Now we're starting to see cities reinvent themselves under a sustainability framework. So one of them that gets a lot of attention is the city of Malmo in Sweden. ICLEI had its World Congress just prior to Rio+20 in the city of Belo Horizonte in Brazil, which has also done wonderful things around food security and participatory budgeting. We have, I mean, really just a growing list of communities ranging from sort of high-tech things like Masdar in the United Arab Emirates, to my own community that I've been involved with, as I mentioned earlier, university at Simon Fraser University. One of the examples I think that's very interesting from university is we've just opened a child care center that is not only built according to the LEED standard, LEED is Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design, but to a standard called the Living Building Challenge. And this means that this building not only produces all of its own energy and harvests its own rainwater and recycles its own waste, I mean, it's basically contributing more to the world than it's taking. And we're building our buildings on former parking areas that are no longer necessary because of good transportation initiatives. So there's all of those kinds of things. But in addition to this child care center being a wonderful example of a green building, perhaps what's most important about it is that we are seeing a green dividend rather than a green premium. So this building, many people still assume that to build green costs more, and to do things sustainably costs more in the short run and or the long run than to do things conventionally. But we have built this building to cost 15% per square foot less than a conventional child care center being built in the same region. So that's what I mean by the green dividend. It's starting to pay off. And if we start to use the community capital framework, if we start to really see that sustainability is about integration and not about trading off environment for economy or economy for social inclusion, but to do all of these things, then it's going to pay off financially and socially and ecologically.
You have been listening to Dr. Mark Roseland of Simon Fraser University on Radio EcoShock. Find out more on my show blog at ecoshock.info. I'll toss in lots of links to Mark's work. And look for Mark's new fourth edition of his classic Towards Sustainable Communities, Solutions for Citizens and Their Governments from New Society Publishers. Mark Roseland, thank you so much for letting us know about these positive changes.
My pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
I can feel the weather changing. I can see it all around, all around. Can't you feel a new wind blowing? Don't you recognize that sound? That sound. Slowly spinning, spinning slowly, slowly changing. I feel something in the air. I feel the rumbling in the ground. I feel the rumbling. I feel the rumbling in the ground. I feel the rumbling. I feel the rumbling in the ground. I feel the rumbling.
Yes, Neil Young, here's a rumblin'. That's from his 2010 album, La Noise. Earlier you heard clips from Brian Eno's instrumental, The Big Ship. I love it. There is a rumblin', that kind of low noise of something big coming, but we can't quite tell what. The mass media news is one big distraction. As the headlines scroll by, I have this creepy feeling there are big stories not being told. One of them is pretty simple. We have built a consumer machine that is chewing up the planet, spitting out toxic waste. Most of the greenhouse gases we pour into the sky are being sucked into the ocean. Radio EcoShock guests like paleoclimatologist Peter Ward have made one thing clear. The ocean makes the oxygen we breathe. The ocean determines the weather. And in the big picture, the state of the ocean dictates that big biological clock of abundance or mass extinction. That's how it works. That's how it is. Today I saw more graphic evidence the ocean is far more disturbed than our weather. Rob Stewart set out to save the sharks from the lunacy of shark fin soup. His audience, and then the ocean experts, told Stewart he was missing the big story. Despite the success of his first film, Sharkwater, Stewart had to fight once again just to make his second film. He spent another 4 years traveling hard to the biological hotspots of the ocean and to the dead zones. What he learned inflamed him. Stewart found out what we all know in our hearts. We need a big change fast in our economy, in our culture, and in our hearts, not just to save the sharks or the polar bears, but ourselves. He's calling for nothing less than revolution. That's the title of his new film.
The conclusion we've come to is that we've built a system doomed to fail. Think of yourself as a body, as an organism. You know your consumption. You know how much food you need to take in a day to survive. You know if you ride a bike, if you drive a car, what you're consuming and what level of destruction you bestow upon the world. But expand that vision a little bigger. What if you were to think of your house as an organism? What if you were to think of this whole science center as an organism, as Toronto as an organism? Think of the consumption of these larger bodies. You know, what does it take to keep Toronto going, to keep New York going, to keep Hong Kong going? These are not sustainable. To feed Toronto, to put the energy in Toronto, you've got to go to the natural world, destroy a bunch of it, ship it here, and that's what we've been doing. And that's why our very life support systems are in jeopardy this century. By the middle of the century, no reefs, no rainforest, 9 billion people, not enough food for everybody, not enough water. We are in trouble. So the issue now is save the humans. This is the biggest issue humanity's ever been up against. It's not like a world war. It's not like we're going to battle to save Great Britain. Now we are in battle to save civilization. And the scientists, they're pretty unanimous on this. We're consuming too much in every level.
You just heard a clip from the TEDx Youth Conference in 2011 in Toronto. The movie Revolution has just been released at the Toronto Film Festival and again at the Vancouver Film Festival. It's a full-length bundle of astounding underwater photography, followed by a quest to find out who can stop our civilization from destroying the ocean and ourselves. We are introduced to creatures hidden below the waves, like a relative of the octopus that is smarter than your house cat, crazy and adorable animals that only nature could dream up. It's a rich life. And it's a dying life. The ocean is becoming acidic. It's getting hotter, and it's filling up with plastic and chemicals. The single biggest threat to all sea life, greater even than deforestation, which does affect the oceans, is the way we dump fossil carbon into the atmosphere. Estimates range from 33% to 50% of all the carbon dioxide we emit from our tailpipes and our coal plants and all the things we make goes into the ocean. Everything that makes a skeleton, from tiny plankton through coral to all fish and sea mammals, they're all endangered by ocean acidification and climate change. If we can't control our emissions quickly, we can't save life in the sea. Stewart rediscovers what I found out in 1990. The oceans campaign is the climate campaign, is the oceans campaign. Next week, I'll bring you a full interview with Rob Stewart, underground filmmaker and unlikely revolutionary. We'll also hear from Lester Brown of the Earth Policy Institute. He's got the facts on rising food costs at home and foodless days abroad. And we'll continue our transition series with food localization in the poorest neighborhood. We opened Radio EcoShock this fall with Gareth Renowden. He and co-host Glenn Williams have managed a new edition of The Climate Show, bridging the time gap between London and rural New Zealand. Check out the new program at theclimateshow.com. Another tip from the film Revolution: only you can educate yourself. Sorry, whatever school you went to didn't teach you what we all need to know. The government won't tell you. Media plans to distract you. As the hard facts roll away the delusions of this mass suicide pact we are living, I encourage you to dig, dig, dig. You can get college-level knowledge free in YouTube and Google Lectures, the cutting-edge science. Watch the TED Talks. Bulk up on your list of blogs that tilt towards natural reality and science. You can find every back show of Radio EcoShock on our website at ecoshock.org. That's free. You can download them. Please tune in and spread them around. Use those links, Facebook, Twitter, everything. Hand out copies to neighbors or on the street. Talk it up. Some of the world's best experts are straining to teach us what they know. We have to strip away layers of ignorance and greed. We need to know the truth, and then we need to act on it. Nothing else will save a livable future for our descendants who we love so much. That is the big story. I'm Alex Smith. This has been Radio EcoShock. Join us next week.